When I said just to clarify, when I said I have Hobbit feels, I don't mean the movie. I mean, yes, I have feels about the movie,
Oh,
but
yeah.
like as far as like my very specific fandom, like the form of my obsession focused in on hobbits. And I'm not gonna like spill it all now because it's not officially begun, but like when I if I get a chance to talk about it, I have many
Oh, yeah.
strong feelings.
Please interject them wherever possible.
Yeah.
This is literally a podcast just about all fandom feels. Like we're not official. We're not picky.
I just love how anachronistic the Shire is compared to the rest of the Earth. Like, that's my biggest thing, and that's why I love it so much. That's why I love hobbits. I mean, obviously, because they're like they're charming in their ways, they're charming in how they like to party and like live simple lives and eat six meals a day. But
Is
like
it seven meals?
I mean I don't I thought it
Breakfast, second breakfast.
was
Breakfast, second breakfast, elevensies, luncheon, afternoon tea, dinner,
How
supper.
many is that? Who
That's
counts?
seven.
That's seven?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough. Seven meals a day.
That's too many
That is
meals.
the correct amount of meals. Nutritionists agree that if you have if you eat more frequently, but you have smaller portions, that's like healthier than having a big meal like three times a day. So hobbits are onto something health-wise.
Yeah, I
But
mean they're doing better than me, which is like three meals a day that are too small.
but yeah, my whole thing is that like all of Middle Earth is, you know, sword and not sandals, but you know, it's like high fantasy, it's like vaguely medieval setting, everybody's got armor and shit. And then over in Middle Earth or over in the Shire, it's like Downton Abbey, it's like upstairs stairs. It's like these polite little Victorian English people with their waistcoats and you know, they're smoking their cute pipes and they got their upper class hobbits and the lower class hobbits. It's just I love it so much. It's so silly when I like realized how much it didn't make sense compared to the rest of Middle Earth. And it's kind of just like funny how every time someone meets a hobbit, they're like, "What the fuck are you?" And
You're gonna have to do this whole rant again when Caitlin gets here.
it.
Realized after I said the thing about the idea of J.R.R. Tolkien being queer, what if he and C.S. Lewis were exes?
Oh, that's gotta be. Okay, dear AO3, hang on. Let me
Oh
go
my
back
God.
to the archive of our own. I'm just gonna look this up real quick. How do I look this up? Is this under RPF?
Oh my God.
It
Can
would probably be under
Okay, how do I find RPF? Would it be oh, celebrities and real people. Here we go,
Yes.
everybody. Here we go.
I love
Okay, where do
and hate
I
it.
find
I love and hate it so much.
I'm gonna need a very tall whiskey after
Oh
this.
my
Okay,
God.
I don't know how to. This
Well,
is difficult because you can't search AO3 by just people, right? I guess
you
you can
can.
search
No, you
people
can. You
and
can.
just Google.
You can literally just like put J.R.R. Tolkien slash C.S. Lewis and see what
We're
comes
going to
up.
hell. We're all going to hell for this.
Okay, go to nerd jail.
Right.
This is by far not the worst thing I have done in
Okay, but just
the
listen. Listen, 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 listen. Listen to me. If we're going to nerd jail, if we're going to nerd hell, so is everybody who's already written fan fiction about them, which
This
I
is true.
guarantee to you exists. I fucking guarantee.
It's
I
gotta be out there,
swear to the
guys.
actual God.
Cursed content. I'm sure it exists, but it's like once you have read this, you read it.
I did a Google search for just J.R.R. Tolkien slash C.S. Lewis AO3, and I clicked on Archive of Our Own tags work C.S.S. Lewis J.R.R. Tolkien. Second result that comes up leads to a 404 page.
Oh my God. The internet doesn't want us to find this cursed content. It exists.
Yeah. I feel like I'm being, like...
This is the start of a horror movie, you know? That's how they start, is you're looking for forbidden knowledge. You're looking for something that was not meant to be discovered by man. And when you find it, that's Samara, that, like, ghost girl that will come out on your computer. Like, you found the forbidden fanfare. You have 7 days to live.
I feel this is the wrong time to mention we're one day going to do an ABO episode.
God, this is probably the hardest I've laughed on the podcast since we had Emily on to talk about ABO and Twilight. Fuck. I'm going to find it, though. I'm going to find this cursed content. I'm going to get myself cursed, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to bring the curse to all of you.
No!
You earned it. I think you've all done a lot of really good work, and I think y'all deserve it.
Great. Love that.
You're welcome.
Well, looks like we're all going to hell.
Yeah, in a handbasket.
Nerd hell is going to be a fun place. It's going to be terrible.
Oh, yeah.
It's
all
fun.
The best people are in nerd hell. I mean, come on. So, welcome everyone back to this podcast officially. We are still going with the Lord of the Rings little roundtable, little circle that we've started. And, you know, who knows? Is this going to be a three-parter? And I just said it was going to be a two-parter, and I'm actually going to make you do three, and then maybe I'm going to have one published.
You're
going to
pull Lindsay Ellis.
You know, could do that too. We'll see what happens. But in this episode today, we have back Betty Brash and our lovely Caitlin and Raina Sinclair all to talk about specifically the Hobbit movies and also maybe just our feelings about Hobbits in general, of which there are many, if your name is Betty Brash.
Yep.
So I think, does anyone want to share what content, what you're into this week, or is what you're into just diving into the Hobbit?
I think we could probably just dive into The Hobbit today.
Great. All right. The Hobbit. Caitlin, would you like to pick up where we left off about Tauriel?
Oh, right. Okay. So, like we said in the first episode, interspecies relationships in Tolkien's world building are literally moving the stars kind of important. And that comes back from the tale of Beren and Luthien. And it's so important to talk about this that I actually have a paragraph marked out here for you guys, if you're willing to be quoted at.
Yes, always.
Okay, it's a pretty...
Don't read Lord of the Rings to me. What? No, nobody says that.
How dare.
So it's a pretty long one, and for context, we're about to enter a scene where Beren, son of, what's his dad's name again? Barahir. So Beren, son of Barahir, has just, you know, spent a winter killing orcs, causing chaos, and he had to flee the forest that he was hiding in from Sauron and his werewolves. Yes, there are werewolves in the Silmarillion. except they're possessed by demigods. That's how they become werewolves. So he just wandered through the mountains. What are they called? I had it right here. The high region of Gorgoroth, or the Mountains of Terror. So he just crossed like an immensely high mountain range. Think like 10 Mount Everests lying together.
Jesus.
And yeah, so, you know, it's full of like invisible spiders and evil spirits and like miniature dragons, which were really like
miniature.
Yeah. They're not like the true dragons of Tolkien's world, these highly intelligent beings. I guess you would call them, there's another term that fantasy writers generally describe them as.
Worm.
Drakes.
Ah.
Yeah. Yeah, so like these little drakes running around in these incredibly high mountains. You know, this guy hasn't eaten anything in like weeks and stuff like that. So,
and he's a werewolf.
He comes up. No, he's a man. He's human. He's mortal. You know, and that plays into this whole story of Beren and Luthien. So, after he stumbles out of the mountain range, this is the scene that's laid upon us. It is told in the Lay of Lethien that Beren came stumbling into Doriath, gray and bowed, as with many years of woe, so great had been the torment of the road. But wandering in the summer in the woods of Neldoreth, he came upon Luthien, daughter of Thingol and Melian, at a time of evening under moonrise, as she danced upon the unfading grass in the glades beside Esgaldion. Then all memory of his pain departed from him, and he fell into an enchantment. For Luthien was the most beautiful of all the children of Ilúvatar. Blue was her raiment as the unclouded heaven, but her eyes were gray as the starlit evening. Her mantle was sewn with golden flowers, but her hair was dark as the shadows of twilight. As the light upon the leaves of trees, as the voice of clear waters, as the stars above the mists of the world, such was her glory and her loveliness, and in her face was a shining light. But she vanished from his sight, and he became dumb, as one that is bound under a spell, and he strayed long in the woods, wild and wary as a beast, seeking for her. In his heart he called her Tinuviel, that signifies the nightingale, daughter of twilight, and in the gray elven tongue, for he knew no other name for her. And he saw her afar as leaves in the winds of autumn, and in winter as a star upon a hill, but a chain was upon his limbs. So in this paragraph, Tolkien tells us a lot, not just how beautiful that Luthien is, but also that she inherited a significant power from her mother, since she is the daughter of Thingol and Melian. Melian is actually a demigod in the Silmarillion, and how Beren and Luthien meet is very similar. It's basically parallel to how her parents meet. Thingol wanders into like some enchanted wood, finds her upon a meadow, and becomes so enchanted that they like were stuck in a bubble inside time for 200 years. Oh, that's how powerful Melian's magic is.
Wow.
So that is... So all of that is very important. So when Tolkien writes about interspecies romances, it's basically meant to be world-changing, a shifting of the fates, so to speak, if you pull from his Mythopoeia essay / poem. So Toriel, as a character herself, I am all for writing more strong female characters into forms of classic literature like Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, but Toriel was written for an ulterior motive, and that ulterior motive was to make money. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, all of those entire movies were just kind of made to make money, and you feel it. Like, they don't feel like a labor of love in the same way that the original trilogy films were. I don't know, to me, they felt like just like, well, this will make some ticket sales especially and perhaps some action figures.
Especially because they divided it. They like made it in a longer into a longer, darker, more serious kind of saga because they were trying to like, you know, do the same thing that Lord of the Rings did so successfully and create this like epic adventure. And like The Hobbit is a kid's book, you know, like it didn't have to be quite that serious.
Yeah, I mean, of all of the films, The Hobbit is the least of which needed to be made into three films for itself.
Absolutely.
Like, were they joking?
So I have discourse for this. So as I've mentioned before, Lindsay Ellis, who I love dearly, did a 3-part series about why The Hobbit sucks.
Yes, discord me, baby. Hit me.
The first part is basically that it was something Peter Jackson never wanted to do. And then was basically forced into it.
How do you get forced into that? I gotta know.
Well, wasn't Guillermo del Toro supposed to do it, and then he dropped out Madness, which never happened. Like,
So that's the thing, is that like she kind of like goes into like what exactly happened and how like there isn't really like an official reason, but the gossip is kind of that Del Toro wanted to make like a monster movie. He wanted to make like a high fantasy, and the studios were like, no, we want Lord of the Rings. We want that sweet, sweet Oscar bait. And so then they brought Peter Jackson back. And then then she goes into the second video, which is about like how there were 5 studios attached to the first film. And the reason they made it a trilogy was so that there could be more money.
Well, yeah, I mean,
it was originally supposed to be only two films, and then they decided, well, let's make it a third one, because like once they got past the first one, then there was only like three studios involved. And she basically goes into like that whole thing. And then the third part is how The Hobbit fucked over the entire country.
Oh my
of New
God.
Zealand. Because they basically, the studio changed the labor laws of New Zealand. They got the prime minister to change the labor laws so that they could basically fuck over the people in New Zealand that were working for the film industry so that they like would just pay all the big bucks to the stars and then tell the New Zealand actors and crew to fuck off.
Insane. Like, especially given the stories that you hear about the first, like the shooting of the first three movies and like the way people turned out for that and everyone was really excited to like be a part of it. I don't know. I mean, there's always shit that goes on behind the scenes that doesn't make it into the lovely edited commentaries, but you know, there's this idea, there's this like mythos of the first three movies being made and just being this like wonderful artistic venture and labor of love for these stories. And you just, when watching, like all I had to do was watch the first Hobbit movie to know that this was not that.
Absolutely. I mean, the original trilogy, watching those movies and then also watching like all the behind scenes footage and like listening to the commentary, that made me want to go into film. Like those movies made me want to like have that adventure and you know, do the same thing. And then it's very obvious, like with The Hobbit, you know, I was excited to have it, honestly, like when they announced that they were doing The Hobbit and that Martin Freeman was going to be playing Bilbo. Like, I was honestly excited because I wanted to return to Middle Earth. But then when it was like, oh, well, we're going to divide it into three movies and we're going to add all this other shit and we're going to make it super dramatic. And I was like, oh, guys, why? Like, it didn't need to be like that. Honestly, like, I feel like the first movie is fine. You know, like the other movies, the quality of the movies gradually gets worse in the Hobbit trilogy. But I feel like the first one was okay because it had elements of the familiar. It had some of the like the charm and the whimsy and the like warmth of the book. Like the scenes when they're at Bag End, when all the dwarves show up and they're singing. Like I thought that was magical. I loved the song that they sang. Like I listened, like I have that soundtrack. I listened to it. But then everything else is just kind of like, okay, all right, you're just milking it. You're just bringing this fandom for all the money, for all the money it's worth. Yep.
And for all of the money and all of the classic brunette blonde slash ship you can get. I've always been a little flabbergasted by the popularity of Bilbo. It's not that I don't get it. Like, I have eyeballs, and I love Slash, and I saw the last Hobbit movie, and it was there. Okay, it was there. It was like, wow, was that gay? That was pretty fucking gay. But, like, I've very much lost interest in this point in my life in subtextual gayness that, like, I can see, but studio executives are like, what? Huh? Where?
Yeah.
What? I'm not gonna do that anymore. And I'm actually in a Bag and Shield Discord group that I never like go in just because I wanted to be around more Lord of the Rings fans. But I was shocked that like the fucking Bilbo people are the ones carrying our torch. Really? Really? They're the last man standing? Really? No offense. No offense to my Bilbo shippers. I get it. Like, I get it. I really do. I really do get it. I get it. I wanted them to kiss too. I get it. But still.
Also, like, Thorin is supposed to be a lot older than he was portrayed in the films.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm watching the film, and I'm just kind of like, yeah, I can't.
They
made not seeing this
so
happening.
You know what? But you know what? I was so confused and angry about that because, like, I love Richard Armitage. Like, I've seen him in other things. So I was, like, I was lusting for that actor before he was Thorin. Because
we're talking about the Red Dragon, am I right? No.
We're talking about North and South, and we're talking about Robin Hood. He was in Robin Hood, and he was really hot.
Oh, yeah.
But he was a bad guy, but he was a hot bad guy. But like, he's really good in period pieces. He's a very handsome man. He's good at playing like a broody, like anti-hero, anti-romantic hero. Oh, yeah. And so when I found out that he was getting cast as Thorin, I was like, okay, they're taking this into an interesting, different direction. I guess they're going to make him hot. They're going to make him like a heroic kind of character. And then they put like fucking prosthetics on his face. And I was like, what was the point? What was the point of that? He's a beautiful man. You covered his face in prosthetics. You still made him sort of hot, but it was just like,
yeah,
this was a decision, and I don't know why, and I don't know that I approve of it, because it's like, either you make him hot and you use the face, you use the beautiful face that you got, or you cast another actor that looks like an old man that has a dwarf face. Like, I don't understand why they had to put all those prosthetics on his face and then still have him be like a kind of dashing, handsome, heroic, you know.
It was very, very Rochester, sort of like, he's ugly, but like, he's supposed to be ugly, but we're gonna make him hot anyway, and you can just pretend that Timothy Dalton is ugly. You can just pretend. Fucking bullshit! Bullshit!
Yeah.
And like, I think it's like almost an elfification of the dwarves in those movies, because they know that like, the elves are the heavy hitters when it comes to the aesthetics and when it comes to the lust, and like, there's not a lot of people going like, yeah, Gimli, like, I could ride that, except for Legolas, but like, you know what I mean? they glossed over that.
Well, it's also interesting because I forget the actress's name.
Pauline Lilly?
But
mm-hmm.
Yes, Evangeline Lilly. Like, they even go into like how she like only signed on to the movie if she wasn't gonna have a like love story or a love triangle.
Oh, what?
You need to watch Lindsay Ellis's like magnum opus about the Hobbit movies, because like, it just has all of this info like you would never learn otherwise.
Yeah, I do need to see this.
But she basically signed on to the movie with the express like thing of like, I'm not going to be in a love story. I'm not going to be in a love triangle. Like, I just want to be in this movie. And then like the first day of shooting, they're like, yeah, you're in a love triangle.
That's cool.
That is so shitty. Caitlin, I definitely want to hear more about your takes on Tauriel and Beren and Luthien and Aragorn and Arwen.
Oh, right. So the big thing about Tauriel is that I think I like to call Tauriel the character as like a knockoff Galadriel almost, because Tolkien's not afraid of writing strong female characters. We see that with Eowyn, we see that with Arwen, we see that with Galadriel. Mm-hmm. You know, we see that in some of the general writings when he talks about some of the battle scenes in the Silmarillion. And he also talks about in the Silmarillion, Melian is a big one as well, and about half of the gods in the creation myth are also female. He understood that if he wanted to complete the circle, so to speak, of his mythopoeia, he also had to have a balance between, you know, the male end of the spectrum and the female end of the spectrum. So, for example, Mandos is known as the god of death, and he handles what's known as the Hall of Mandos. And then he has, I'm gonna butcher her name, so I apologize to everybody listening here. I think it's Nirion or Nirion, and she is known as the Goddess of Sorrow. And she plays a significant part in the early years of world building. Like, they use her tears to try and revive the trees, which are supposed to be the sun and the moon before the sun and the moon were supposed to exist. That was a thing. But her tears are known to be tears of revival. So when she cries in true sorrow, like, the land around her will just end up flourishing with new life, which I think was Tolkien, if not his actual consciousness, like his subconscious and how he dealt with the feminine sphere in the real world, you know, says a lot about that. Also, fun fact, music plays a big part in the Silmarillion, and that's heavily inspired by his wife Edith, who was a classical musician and an orchestra player before she married him.
I love it on their graves.
Yes,
it says Beren and Luthien.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the tale of Beren and Luthien is also heavily inspired by his marriage to Edith. A lot of historians like to play around with the idea that if Edith had not been more or less betrothed to Tolkien by the time he left for World War One, he may have ended up dead in a ditch somewhere.
But his love kept him alive.
Yeah, that's kind of how literally the tale of Beren and Luthien is. I'm not going to read the paragraphs to you, but the general tale of Beren and Luthien is that Beren falls in love with this beautiful, beautiful, you know, semi-demi goddess or whatever, you know. And it's found out by her father, Thingol. And he says, well, you can't marry my daughter until you get a Simmeril, which plays a significant part in the story. That's why the book is called The Silmarillion. So Beren attempts to get the Simmeril from Morgoth, aka Lucifer. And in the process almost fails, if not for the help of Luthien and her magic. She ends up cloaking herself, dances Morgoth into a trance, literally steals the jewel from his iron crown, and then runs away with it, laughing to the bank, while carrying Beren, firefighter style.
Love her.
Yes. So they got to be very happy, but it was only for very brief, because Beren had been, you know, heavily wounded and heavily scarred throughout this whole ordeal, and had also been bitten by a werewolf as well.
What?
Yes. So there's like a whole thing about him having werewolf powers and whatnot.
Isn't she straight up a vampire at some point?
Yeah, there's that as well. There's shape-shifting powers. Those are pretty common for, like, most folks who have creation-esque powers, as I like to call it. You know, she is the daughter of a demigod, after all. And at the end of it, Luthien finds out that her immortality, coming from both of her parents, is intricately tied to Beren's mortality, meaning that she'll never arrive to the Hall of Mandos or be reincarnated by Mandos should her mortal vessel become frail, or she dies, you know, or something grievously happens to her. So she finds out that when Beren dies, she will die as well. And she learns to accept that. The both of them learn to accept that. And they end up like living their very short lives happily together. Yeah. So that gets replayed with Aragorn and Arwen. I mean, there was like, what, 4 scenes in Return of the King where Elrond is like, you have to forget this guy. Your immortality can't be tied to him. And Arwen is kind of like, fuck you, Dad. I love this guy and I'm going to love him forever. And at least he's Numenorean, because he'll live for like another 200 years. You know, and it's through her powers that Narsil ends up getting reforged. So when we finally, rounding back to Tauriel. Tauriel as a character doesn't have anything like specifically mythopoeic about her, or at least actually pertains to the argument of the misomythias, the myth hater, and not so much the philia mythos or the myth lover. And the whole thing between her and Legolas, and then her and was it Killy or Philly?
You know, the Philly. What the hot one?
I'm going to be honest. They were both hot. Like, that's the problem, right? Honestly, they look so similar in the film that and I grew up with a pair of twins, right? So that says a lot about me, where I'm like, is that one Philly or is the other one Killy? I can't tell.
He was the one that is Poldark. That actor is also very hot and good in a period piece, and was another one that I was like, why are you making him one of the goofy young dwarves? This is a choice. Do we want?
Yes, I have a visual of who you're talking about now. So to me, like, if the production team wanted to write in a love story like that, you know, it would have been just a little bit easier to sort of replay the tale of Beren and Luthien as like a C plot story, except using you know, 2 side characters from Lake Town instead of having to shoehorn it. Cause they were trying to cash in on the whole Aragorn Arwen story. And I was seething through this entire trilogy being like, this isn't how this works. This isn't how any of this works, you know, especially because the entire point of Philly, Killy, and Thorin dying at the Battle of the Five Armies. I'm sorry, everybody. There's spoilers here.
It's fine.
The book has been out for, what, half a century now? I'm sorry, guys. You're going to get spoiled.
It's fine. It's fine.
The entire point of them dying at the end of the book is to be a major world-building significance, because Thorin, Killian, Philly are actually the last of the direct descendants of the House of Durin, the first dwarves that came to Middle-earth. So, like, again, it's the closing of the circle, the closing of the myth, bringing everything back to full circle. And just, like, trying to get Killy to be like, I love you, dead, just brings no significant plot, especially to, you know, young kids or young children or even just, like, budding fantasy lovers. You know, you walk away being like, well, that happened.
I feel like it definitely, the love triangle aspect kind of cheapened, you know, the characters, you know, importance, significance, the meaning that they had connected to the fate of the dwarves. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a thing that most people were not a fan of Toriel for, and it's a bummer because the idea of having a strong female character is great, especially in such a male-centric narrative, but they had to go and make it stupid, so. Hold on, I'm going to quickly look up which one is Philly and which one is Keely. Me, I'm like, what kind of fucking fan am I? Okay, so.
I mean, I don't remember everything about every fandom I've ever been a part of.
One is the blonde one, and one is the
darker, the brunette,
sexy one. Yeah, they're actually, they're both pretty cute.
Keely is the hot one. All right. I mean, they're both, the hot one. They're both beautiful. Kind of. Keely is Aiden Turner, aka Poldark, aka he was in that other show, the vampire
being human.
Yeah, he was in that. Yeah, he's a really handsome, beautiful man. And so he was the love interest dwarf, which was stupid and, like, cheapened the character, cheapened everything that happened.
I think the other thing is that, like, because I know that, like, one of the great pairings of Lord of the Rings was, what's his name? The dwarf Which and dwarf? The elf. The dwarf and the elf.
Legolas
and Gimli, yes. Yes.
Okay. Okay, I have a lot of feelings about Legolas and Gimli.
But
dive in, take me on.
Basically, the point that I was making
there
is that, like, so their whole thing is that, like, the elves and dwarves hate each other, right? Oh. And, like, them becoming friends, or as some of us have considered, gay lovers, is, like, the first big step in, like, peace on Middle Earth.
It was significant. It was very, like, their relationship was a milestone, and it was touching and beautiful. And it's whether you think of them as romantic partners or platonic, they were soulmates. Like,
Those boys are married, regardless of whatever else is involved in their relationship. They're very married.
Love them.
And then, so the whole thing of that love triangle kind of cheapens that relationship.
Ugh.
And, like, it kind of, like, It makes, like, the whole arc of Legolas learning to love and care about a dwarf, like, I mean, I guess you could kind of talk about the redemption angle, but it's really fucking weak.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's fucking weak. And not only that, I really, the aesthetics of the dwarves in, like, the prettification of the dwarves in the Hobbit movies bothers me for, like, exactly that reason, because their aesthetics are just more in line with the way they had the aesthetics for the elves in the first three movies. Like, that's my take. And I'm just like, ah, but they're supposed to have this, like, rift, and the elves are always, like, shitting on the dwarves for blah, blah, blah. And, like, I don't know, at least let the dwarves own that. Like, don't make them more like elves. I feel like that's rude to the dwarves.
It really is.
The dwarves are Art Deco and the elves are Art Nouveau.
Wow.
Yeah, it's no, I can definitely agree with you on that. Like, I actually think it would have been more in line with the world building of Tolkien that if Toriel had loved Killy so much that when Killy dies at the Battle of the Five Armies, that she ended up dying afterwards. Because, fun fact, there are two main ways that an elf can die. One is through great physical wounding, so getting cut in half. If you're an elf, you cannot survive that. But also great emotional wounding, such as being separated from a soulmate. So at the end of The Lord of the Rings, Legolas actually gets to bring Gimli to Valinor, to the Undying Lands, or the Grey Harbor, as it's called at the end. And one, I find it especially heartwarming at the fact that Legolas, who is, you know, in my mind, the Sylvan Hick of the entire group.
Love that.
I love those memes so much.
Yes, especially if you're a linguistic nerd, because you understand, like, Legolas speaks multiple types of Elvish dialect and code switches because his dad couldn't be bothered to bring linguistical textbooks from his homeland, because he's like, I don't need you guys. Piss off.
And then in The Hobbit, of course, he's this glamorous and lovely fucking Lee Pace.
Yeah, I'll give props to Lee Pace taking such, like, what is supposed to be a terrible Elvish character and turning him into this, like, hot daddy trope.
I was literally gonna say daddy. I was actually gonna say daddy, yeah. Oh,
he's a hot daddy.
Elf daddy!
I mean, it's not wrong.
I'm not wrong. Yeah. I'm just an asshole.
So, what would we call that? Like, Thren Daddy you will?
Wow.
Thren Daddy you will?
Thren Daddy you will.
Woof.
So, one, props to Legolas for making, like, a really great argument that Lily sums up to you. If you do not let me bring my best friend in the world to the Undying Lands, I will literally die. Aww. And everybody is kind of like, yeah, no, that tracks.
Yeah.
You know, because again, that's all, like, written into the Silmarillion. The second one is that because if my linguistic understanding from the Silmarillion is correct, Legolas doesn't know a lick of Quenya, which is the mother tongue of the Elvish people. So if he ends up sailing to Valinor with Gimli and he doesn't know a lick of his mother tongue, he shows up to, like, the shores of Valinor and the Noldor of Valinor are just sort of miming at him, being like, who are you and what is this and why are you here?
I always thought of it as, like, the difference between Hebrew and Yiddish. You can vaguely understand. Like, you have funny accents. What are you saying?
My beer is the shame.
Here for the Jewish hot takes.
Yep. Boy, they.
Yeah, it's, you know, and it's funny because when I talk about this to my friends being like, oh yeah, like, Legolas and Gimli loved each other, it may not have been in, like, the hot slash ficky gay way that fan fiction wants us to believe, but I also think Tolkien was also sort of exploring his connection to other men in early 20th century England, where the concept of having close, familial, platonic, and even pseudo-romantic relationships with other men was not only heavily frowned upon, but also heavily legislated against.
And yeah, and it's so, like, and that was, like, such a big deal as far as, you know, the camaraderie that he developed, like, that men in general developed during those periods of war. Like, it was very important to have friendships, to have strong friendships. It's how you survive, and that's reflected in so many of the relationships in Lord of the Rings, because they're going through this heavy trauma, this, like, nightmare situation, and the only way to make it through is through the support of your friends. So it's like, yes, you can also look at it from the shippy fandom angle of, like, oh my god, they're super gay. Like, they're super gay.
Yeah, I don't feel like Gimli and Legolas have that, like, tin hattie, like, whoa, Tolkien's trying to tell me something. Like, when I watch Star Trek and I see Kirk and Spock interact, I get like that. But Legolas and Gimli don't give me that vibe. Like, they have an actual real, like, canon relationship that is what it is and stands on its own. And if I want to explore their relationship sexually through fan fiction, like, that's all coming from me and my desires, which is a very different way. I just feel differently about them as a ship than I do about other ships and other things that I've been into that weren't overtly queer in canon.
For sure.
I mean, that's fair. I think And again, I have no horse in this race, so I can just spout whatever the fuck I want.
That's but like, true.
So like, I don't know. Like the way that I kind of am thinking about it right now is so like, there were like those like poets during World War One, and a couple of them were queer, and like would write like letters to like their lovers, like without people really like. Like it was so subtle because it had to be subtle so that people like until like decades after their deaths were like, oh yeah, no, totally. They were in love. And it kind of like, to me, I'm just kind of imagining Gimli and Legolas having that sort of like relationship of like the two soldiers at war during World War One in love.
That's lovely.
And that's.
Yeah. I mean, again, it gives me almost, I guess, yeah, I would probably associate my appreciation for their relationship. Like, I tend to go for pairings that are like sort of that brotherhood camaraderie kind of level, but with another like deeper level to it.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that's like two men that are just really close and they're just like, they're just there for each other. And they're just really there for each other, you know, and two guys taking care of each other. Yeah, that's my vibe.
Yeah, I totally get that vibe.
You're all very sorry, lucky that I don't actively have a copy of Maurice on my lap to like open it up and peek through and be like, and here's some quotes that I would single out in particular to like exemplify the type of relationship. But I lent it to another queer trans mask friend, so I don't have it.
Yeah, I get those kind of vibes from Samwise and Frodo.
Oh, yes!
You know, they're really big. Like, I actually have a quote pulled up from Return of the King that I think sort of exemplifies like Samwise's love for Frodo, not necessarily like in an overtly, on the surface level, Samwise and Frodo are supposed to be like written as parallels of unifying classes via young men going to war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because by the Return of the King, you know, they're Frodo and Sam are literally behind enemy lines. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just trying to survive to get to the top of Mount Doom to throw this stupid ring into the fire. And there's a quote from Return of the King, and it's probably from the scene where like Frodo passes out and Samwise has to carry him to Mount Doom in order to get the ring into the fire, because Samwise isn't going to pick it up on his own. There's like a whole other monologue about it a couple pages before it. But in this paragraph, it goes, one tiny hobbit against all the evil the world could muster. A sane being would have given up, but Samwise burned with a magnificent madness, a glowing obsession to surmount every obstacle, to find Frodo, destroy the ring, and cleanse Middle-earth of its festering malignancy.
Ugh.
He knew he would try again, fail perhaps, and try once more, a thousand times if need be, but he would not give up the quest.
Sam, fuck, I have MVP. Goosebumps.
Sam is
MVP.
Best hobbit, goodest boy.
Yeah, no, like,
the real hero.
If I needed a hobbit in my corner, it would be Samwise. Not even Frodo, not even Merry and Pippin, even though I love Merry and Pippin to bits.
Mm-hmm.
Agree.
Samwise in my corner, hands down.
Sam becomes like the mayor of the Shire. Like, Sam goes from,
as he should.
Yeah.
From being like a very kind of awkward like gardener, very like humble and self-deprecating, to being like in charge of the entire country, and I love that for him.
Mm-hmm.
I love him.
Yeah, he's like Jerry Gurgich but actually competent.
Oh my god, how dare you.
I didn't get that reference.
Rick, oh my god. Jerry. He is not a Jerry.
I know he's not a Jerry.
God damn it.
That's why it's funny.
Jerry wishes he were a Sam.
Seriously. We should all aspire to be Sam. He's great. He's a big hero.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, the Hobbits and the Hobbit, which, you know, pulling back to the Hobbit series, and having these friendships and relationships, it's really noted by the end of the book that Frodo is actually taking a shining to Gandalf, and has declared him like a lifelong friend. And that relationship is very important, because without it, we wouldn't have the entire premise to The Lord of the Rings, because it's Bilbo who, you know, confides in Gandalf and gives him the ring. and says, I can't take this with me to Rivendell. And it's from there where Gandalf is like, something doesn't feel right about this.
What's crazy to me, and I've told like my friends who are not as like hardcore of Lord of the Rings fans, that, you know, in the movie it's seen as kind of like a blip on the timeline of like Gandalf doing his research, but then in the book, isn't it like 20 years goes by? Like,
yeah,
Frodo, like Bilbo disappears, dumps the ring onto Frodo. Frodo's like just come of age, he's 33, which is like the Hobbit equivalent of like turning 18, I guess. And like, yeah, he's just like, now he's the boss of the house, he has Bag End all to himself. And then like Gandalf's like, let me do a little research, I'll come back to you, like hold that thought. And then he comes back like 20 years later.
Yeah, like, Frodo's literally like 50 years old.
Yeah, he's
a totally different part of his life.
Starts. And like, yeah, and the he's just like, so you need to dump your comfortable lifestyle and get rid of this ring. But it's like, yeah, it's crazy to me that it takes Gandalf that long to like figure out this ring is evil.
Yeah,
he was too high. It took him that long because he was too high.
He got lost a bunch of times, like just. He just kept, I mean, we see this in more. He's like, I have no memory of this place.
Like, if Gandalf had a smartphone with like Google on it, it would be a very different series. People always go on about like, oh, if they just taken the Eagles. No, no, no. You give Gandalf just one singular smartphone with some service, he would have a way easier time of everything.
Yeah. Even with an eagle, he would still get turned around. He's like, I knew I should have taken a left turn at Albuquerque, and it's like, Gandalf.
Yeah, I have a lot of feelings about people making the argument being like, oh, they could have just ridden the eagles over to Mordor, and I'm like, that's not how this works. That's not how any of this works, guys.
Yeah. You still have to convince the eagles, first of all. And also, there were, like, tons of fell beasts in the air. There were, like, plenty of things that could have been an issue for them, even if they were riding on eagles.
Yeah.
And also, eagles have to sleep. Like,
it's not even that. It's like, okay, so the eagles actually have, like, an allegorical representation of fate, because they are the literal manifestation of the hand of God. That's like the entire point of the eagles in the series. To be more specific, the eagles are a physical like ally, I guess you could say, of Mandos, who is the king of Valinor. He's basically the god of earth and wind. You know, the creation myth has like this whole, Tolkien goes on for like 4 pages about how great Mandos is. And I'm just like over here being like, yeah, you gotta keep jerking it or what?
I mean, that's how I feel about J.R.R. Tolkien's writing in general.
You gonna keep jerking it or what? That's
get on the pod or get off.
Yeah, so the eagles themselves really only appear like maybe a handful of times over the recorded 3,000 plus years. That is the Silmarillion, the Hobbit, and the Lord of the Rings, plus all the appendices and the unfinished stories. And they're meant to be an allegory as like the literal hand of God realigning the circle of fate back to its original closure. So when the eagles come to save Bilbo and the gang, you know, that's again the gods of Valinor saying, you know, the line of Durin has to end, so we have to make this adventure happen. You know, when so the go ahead.
Are you saying they're a literal Deus Ex Machina?
Yes.
Yes.
That's why they're a Deus Ex Machina. It's because they are a Deus Ex Machina.
Ex Machina.
They are the hands of God.
Oof.
Well. Yeah, it's said a lot more eloquently, a lot more beautifully in, you know, in Tolkien's writing, but essentially the eagles themselves, because they're connected so closely to the magic of Arda, and by the time the Lord of the Rings happens, the magic is waning, you know, like Galadriel says this, Elrond says this, you know, even the hobbits and the men of Minas Tirith say this, and, you know, eagles are kind of like, well, there's not really anything we can do about it. You're just gonna have to foot it yourself, guys.
Yep.
Yeah. So that's my rant on eagles in Lord of the Rings.
It just tickles me immensely that people were like, the eagles are such a Deus Ex Machina, and they're literally meant to be a Deus Ex Machina.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's why I never get offended when people are like, oh, but it's such a Deus Ex Machina thing. And I'm kind of like, yeah, because if you like read the Silmarillion or if you read the subtext of his books, it kind of goes hand in hand with some of his own foundational beliefs. I was reading about it in this book called The Power of the Ring by Stratford Caldicott. I recommend reading it with a very critical eye. The author is pretty much biased towards Tolkien's Catholic upbringing and that lens in which he sees the world, which is, at one point fair, but the other point, I think he gives a little too much credence to Tolkien's theological upbringing and his theological background and how much it influences Lord of the Rings. Again, going back to Mythopoeia and his entire essay about myth making.
So I think as a to get into our closing remarks here, what do you feel that you've learned like from Lord of the Rings? What's been your takeaway, the elements of it that have really, I guess, impacted your day-to-day life? Because I know that I know that it's impacted mine.
My feels are very much still in line with how I felt as a child when I got into Lord of the Rings, except less depressed. I mean, no, I'm still
Mood.
mentally unwell,
Yeah.
but in a different way. No, but when I was a kid, I read the books and I like inhaled all of this content and I was, role playing online and drawing fan art and writing fan fiction and just like diving into this world. I so very much wanted it to be real and I wanted to experience that kind of grand adventure and the epic friendships and relationships that all the characters experience. And I just felt like, oh, life is so mundane. Everything is so boring. There's no magic, there's no adventure. But of course, that was me living in Marine Park, which for listeners, if you don't know, that's like the middle of nowhere in Brooklyn. It's like the suburbs. It's very boring. It's very remote. And I felt like, I was just ready for my life to begin. And then, however many years later, it's been more than a decade, decade and a half. Like, yes, I've had so many more adventures since then. And it was very much my experience and why I've continued to relate to the Hobbits was being part of this very small world and being very curious about the larger world and wanting to go on adventures and wanting to have these grand things happen. And, some of my dreams have definitely changed because, like I said earlier, watching the movies, watching the Lord of the Rings trilogy and all the behind the scenes footage, all the documentaries and the commentaries, it made me want to go into film because I felt like that was the closest that I would get to having that kind of a grand adventure. But I did do that for a while. I worked as a PA and I was on film sets and it just I became disillusioned about it.
Working as a PA will do that.
Yeah, it was soul crushing. It was kind of like when Frodo is like starting to get he's starting to get tired. He's starting to like feel the weight of the ring. He's like, all right, I'm done with this. I want to go home. I'm tired of this adventure. This adventure sucks. But like that, I kind of like I got over it. But I feel like I've had many more interesting and wonderful adventures since then. And I definitely feel appreciative of Lord of the Rings and Tolkien's writing and Peter Jackson's films. For kind of inspiring that in me, for like giving me something to feel passionate about and exploring my skills, working on my skills as far as, art and writing and all that. And just, giving me a curiosity about the world and wanting to travel and wanting to see different things.
That's beautiful. I love that. Caitlin, do you want to go?
Yes, give me 2 seconds. I'm pulling up the quote I wanted to use.
Of course.
Beautiful.
I just want to say this is like the most quotes we have ever had in one of our
And that, like,
Machina
of course, it would happen.
cycles.
Of course, it would happen on the Lord of the Rings episode.
I mean, it's a dense subject, so of course the dialogue is going to be dense.
Yeah, we've had certainly some highfalutin commentary.
I like that Caitlin is bringing the academia and the like, the really insightful looks at the work.
Yeah.
And I'm over here like, hobbits are Downton Abbey! Downstairs! And I love them in their little waistcoats!
And I'm just in the corner watching the jello beans.
Oh my
slug.
God,
jello. You and your jello.
There's always room for jello.
That's, yeah.
There is always room for jello.
But in the meantime, I can talk a little bit about, I guess, how Lord of the Rings has affected my life, which is just to say that, I don't know, I dyed my hair platinum blonde again recently, and I'm not saying that that's because of Legolas and Galadriel, but it's also not because of them. I mean, I feel like I actually painted my bedroom in sort of what I had researched online to be an elfish color scheme.
What color is it?
Like a minty seafoam green on the walls, and then I did
a very
dark, rich wood. Like I painted, there was this like reddish sort of wood as all of the trim, and we had to put in French doors for me because there wasn't a door on the room when we moved in. And so I painted the doors this dark, like dark chocolatey brown, and did all of the trim to match. And now my sibling lives in that room and says it looks like mint chocolate chip ice cream. No, it's elvish, but fine.
Excuse you. It's elvish. Thank you very much.
It's elvish mint chocolate chip ice cream. Thank you.
I love that description. I feel like your place sounds very classy. I wish I could paint my walls too, though I wouldn't go with elf colors. Probably wouldn't even go with hobbit colors. As much as I love the hobbit lifestyle and like what they represent, I don't know if I want the like rustic country chic kind of aesthetic.
I love the elf aesthetics are almost like almost there's this almost sci-fi-ish element to them. Like they look like they look like an alien race that populates a planet millions of light years away. It's
otherworldly.
It's very otherworldly. And I just, there's always been something about being just kind of just to the left of our world. And I was like, yeah, that's where I want to live. Just slide off of this world a little bit and fall into wherever the fuck those elves are. That's where I want to live.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, even though I'm a hobbit person, aesthetically, I feel like Lothlorien.
Oh, right?
Like the fucking, the trees, all the city, their entire city is on trees, and it's so beautiful.
I feel like Rivendell probably, I always loved, like, I fucking love Galadriel. I've been a little bit gay for Galadriel my whole life.
Who isn't?
But I really wanted Lothlorien to be like, yes, this is obviously, I'd go to Lothlorien because it's most beautiful. But honestly, I think Rivendell is probably my spot. Like, there's a little bit more of maximalism there in a way. Yeah. It just feels a bit more bedecked. And Lothlorien's a bit more minimalist. And I've got to go with all the tapestries. And like, they have that one little garden area that's just a bunch of fucking like little statues. And just, oh, and here's the shards of Narsil, a very important artifact, just chilling in the statue garden.
Rivendell is also beautiful. I mean, it's like in a valley and there's like a beautiful river.
It looks great in the fall. I mean, that's
I feel like point. Rivendell is like a perfect like Airbnb location. Like I would vacation there. I would go there just to like relax and or like if you want to go out of town, if you want to go like upstate and you want to like get away from the hustle and bustle of the city, and there's no coronavirus and you just want to like write your novel. You just like want to work on your novel for a month. And
yeah, it's like taking a trip up the Beacon.
Are you saying
or like?
Are you saying Rivendell is the Hudson Valley?
Honestly, that's actually really fair. And I do love all of those towns so much. And you're right. There's a similarity in my love for like all of those lovely little Hudson Valley towns.
It's so pretty. I think I was going to say something. Oh, yes. Stevie, you commenting about the fact that you like dyed your hair. I feel like when I was a kid and I was like, super into Lord of the Rings and I was like, I'm literally a hobbit, I'm short and chubby, I love to eat, I love to like chill and party, and I got like curly hair, I was super into that. And this year, I like took a big risk with cutting my hair in a dramatically different hairstyle. And I feel like this is the most Hobbity I've ever looked in my life.
And you look adorable. And I want all of our listeners, I want our listeners to know you look adorable.
Thank you so much. But yeah, I'm just like really feeling my oats. I'm like living my Hobbit life.
Yes.
I'm home all the time. I mean, listen, I hate 2020 and I hate that I'm stuck at home. I would love to be like back in nightlife and out there. But also, I mean, I got what I wanted when I was a kid. I'm a Hobbit. I've had adventures. Now I'm just hanging out at home, just eating all day. Eating a bajillion meals all the time.
That's fucking beautiful. And I love that for you. I love that. I love that.
That's the positive spin on this nightmare timeline that we've been living.
I mean, me and Betty are basically living the same life. We cut our hair, we eat all the time, and we send fandom shit to each other back and
forth. It's a good dynamic to have. Caitlin, have you pulled up that citation yet?
I did pull up the quote I actually wanted. There's a lot to pull from. My general takeaway from reading Tolkien's work is that he had this intense desire to suss out what it meant to be human, what it meant to have humanity in a world where at his time was learning about things like the Big Bang Theory, about tectonic plate shifts, about how the universe functioned. You know, all this very new and sometimes scary information was coming out. So there's a quote actually from Gandalf, and I forgot which part of this of the trilogy it comes from, but he says, "It is not our part to master all the tides of the world, but to do what is in us for the succor of those years wherein we are set, uprooting the evil in the fields that we know, so that those who live after may have clean earth to till."
Gandalf. Oh my god. That hits.
Yeah. A lot of this is like very much like Tolkien's way of trying to suss out what it means to do good in a world that you're in. Everybody likes to quote that famous quote being like, I wish the ring were not with me. Yeah. And, you know.
So do all who live to see such times.
You can't decide whether. Yes. That one. That's the one I'm thinking of. So to me, I was not seeing so much like Tolkien's world building foundational truths like being worked from the ground up. What I was seeing was a man trying to suss out what it meant to be himself in a world that was changing a lot faster than he was comfortable with. And that's something, especially in the times we're living in now, it's something I can really sympathize with and empathize with on top of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's my general takeaway from Lord of the Rings. You know, that and being a giant linguistic nerd and all the fun things that come with working with a foundational myth like the myth of the elves. And where do they come from? Where do they stem from? Where did this great evil come from? Things like that. Spoilers, the evil came from the start. It was intentionally written into the book.
Where did you come from? Where did you go?
Where did you come from?
I was sitting here with that
Morgoth takes off his face. He takes off the mask, and it was Cotton Eye Joe the entire
time.
We are nothing if not classy at this podcast.
Minor and dumb but cute to add.
Yes.
When I was 13, when I was a wee baboo, and I was first like deeply obsessed with Lord of the Rings, I went to my first nerdy convention out on Long Island. I went to the Icon convention. I made my brother drive me because I was like, I don't know how to get out there. You're doing this. You're driving me out there. And I went solely because Billy Boyd, who plays was there. He did a Q&A and he also did like a signing. So I like went to the Q&A and I asked him a dumb question that made me very shy and awkward. Like, what was it like wearing the Hobbit feet? Because I couldn't think of anything to say. And I just like wanted to talk to him. And he was very charming. It was very cute. But I was a very awkward 13-year-old girl. And then for the autograph, he signed my copy of Lord of the Rings and I still have it. And it's like very special to me. And there is a photo. My brother snuck a photo of him signing my book for me, and I just look so like delighted, but very like very dorky. It's like the, you know, the Goosebumps Irma Gerd girl. Reminiscent of that energy. Like, I didn't have braces or pigtails, but I was very like very dorky, very small, very happy. And this was taken with like a disposable camera because this was like 2001 or 2002.
Oh, and it's precious.
And I still have this photo. But so flash forward to New York Comic Con 2019, where Billy Boyd came back, and I went to get, I don't think I did a picture or an autograph. I think it was just like, oh, you can take a selfie with him. They had like a few options. And I was like, I want to take a selfie with you. And I told him about that experience that was like so many years ago. He was shocked that it was,
oh my God,
what, 2019 minus 2002? Yeah.
18 years.
He was shocked that I was like, that I was 13 in that photo. I showed him the photo and I told him that story and he was like, what, you? And I was like, yeah, man. I mean, and so we took the selfie and we also have some pictures that like a third party, there was like a, I don't know, there was a helper or assistant or something. Like, they took pictures of us. And so I have all these really adorable pictures of me, no makeup. This was like the fourth day of Comic-Con. I was tired of cosplaying, so I'm like not wearing any kind of costume or makeup. And it's just me and Billy Boyd. And it's just, oh my God, we came full circle. It was such a validating, rewarding experience. One of like my top five fandom moments in my life.
That is amazing. I can't think of a better note to end this wonderful adventure on. And thank you all so much for doing this with us. This has been a real, real and true delight for me.
Thank you for having us. It was so fun to dive back into this and like get back into that headspace. I had a GeoCities website when I was a teenager.
Oh, preach.
RIP GeoCities. Yeah,
the Wayback Machine found it, and it's very cringy. I have to show it to you. It's called, it uses my Muggle name, but it's Betty's Hobbit Hole, and it's, oh, it's so cringy. Oh. I gotta show you guys.
Yes, please, please send that. That is precious. Does anyone have anything that you'd like to plug today?
In end of January, we're gonna be doing our annual charity show. And once again, in terms of like nostalgia and remembering your youth, we're doing a Tumblr theme.
Oh yes. I am so excited about that, and I think I still need to submit my own bid to do something if you still need people.
Please do. We need more submissions.
Amazing. Caitlin, do you have anything you'd like to plug? The Instagram?
Yeah. So if anyone wants to follow me for my hot takes and pictures of my cat, you can follow me on @HittyVane on Instagram.
Whiskey is adorable.
That is a very
shout out to Whiskey.
Can confirm.
Yeah, next time I come on, I'll tell the story of how I got this cat.
Just do a whole episode about cats.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I ship my cat with happiness and a warm bed. And I've had a great time with all of this, with this whole Lord of the Rings related session.
Amazing. Thank you so much for prompting this and for having me involved.
Thank you. So I just have one final question for everybody. Do you wear wigs?
What?
Have you worn wigs? Then the Uber figs.
Oh my god!
I don't understand this reference.
Now I'm like laughing, I'm diving into my blankets. I'm like hiding my face, laughing.